God has really blessed me. You know, he let me work in D.C., let me work with EIB in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley. And he's shown me through all those experiences that there is one problem and one solution, and that's why we do this show.
Welcome to A Disciple's View with Todd Herman.
When the God of the universe created the world, he didn't snap his fingers or wink his eye. The Lord spoke. He said, let there be light. Because we believe, we speak about the happenings in this world as we remain mindful that our true home is with Jesus Christ and his kingdom. I'm Todd Herman, and welcome to A Disciple's View. So, of course, Christmas is coming. You know this. It's a commercial thing. It's also, for us Christians, one of the most holy days in all of Christianity, the birth of the Savior. And at church, in our youth group, some of the leaders have been going to the stage and looking at Christmas through the view of some of the other participants. And this was interesting to me, particularly the view of Herod. And as I think about the view of Herod at the time, I can't help but wonder what the Herods of our age would do. Or are they already doing it? Are they already doing it? So King Herod was appointed to be king of the Jews. He was himself, as I understand it, half Jewish. And he was a, well, politician and then some, a murderous man who killed his supposedly favorite wife, had his sons killed, and killing was a solution to him for a lot of problems, some of them small, some of them big. He was a builder of buildings, often things that, of course, would make Herod the story and Herod the memory. And it appears if you read about King Herod's, he was animated by concern for power. That was what animated everything he did, including the murders of family members and wives and sons. Power. He chose to rule through the process of fear. Well, and occasionally handing out this or that, keeping the people happy, a Jewish version of bread and circuses. And Jewish people knew this about Herod. Some of them, of course, would have said, hey, it's okay. King has got to do what a king's got to do. Others, of course, would know about the brutality and consider it just that. It's a tempting thing for us to, in our age, go, well, they weren't very evolved then. They might not have understood all this. They were the same as we are. Their IQs were the same as we are. In some ways, they were probably smarter than we are because they had to be. So when Herod's had built up this power, and he knew that he served, if you want to call it serving, at the pleasure of Rome, he, of course, had to manage up. So managing up, he couldn't go around killing Roman officials if they got in his way. Or if he did, he'd have to have it done very quietly, and not in an open sense, not like he did the other killings. So he knew he had to manage up to an authority. Now, being half Jewish, of course, he was familiar with God. I don't think any Jew at that time would be unfamiliar with God. How could they be? But he sure didn't act like it. But then again, God warned the Jewish people. When you choose a human king, here's what you're going to get. Now imagine the rumors about the Messiah, the birth of the Messiah. And when that started to leak into his consciousness and people started to tell him this is coming. And of course, we know about the wise men who came to tell him. Were the wise men the first, the only? Imagine that man's heart, if you want to think of his heart, which is cold and dark, covetous, a man, I think, just absolutely captured by evil. That the Messiah has come in the form of a baby. What would the first response be? A baby? A baby. A tiny little being. And I'm to fear this? The king of the Jews. What changed? What caused him to make the decision to have murdered every child below the age of, or male child, two and below, in Bethlehem. What changed? I mean, you have a guy who had unlimited power. When you can order the deaths of any male child below the age of two, you have unlimited power. When you can kill your favorite wife and not go to jail and your sons, you have unlimited power. Unlimited only by Rome. So in that sense, Rome let him do what he wanted to do. The wise men came to him and they told him about the birth of this Messiah. And was it the historical significance? Herod was not stupid. Far from it. Herod could manage up to Rome. He could manage the mechanisms of power, keep enough infrastructure going that the people didn't revolt, keep enough bread coming that the people didn't revolt, keep Rome from going in and ruining, destroying the temples so the people could have their temples. That managing up, I mean, that was functional too. I'm sure there were times where Herod had to say, hey, please don't destroy that temple. That's just going to cause a revolt. Not that he cared about revolts or the people or temples, but he cared about his power. So was it when the wise men came and said, oh, we've been studying this for a long time, and here's what the prophecy says, and this is happening, and the child's going to be born in the next few nights, and we're headed down there. Was that what changed? Was that when he decided, I need to kill all these children? I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, this is an exploration of looking at through his point of view. We can't know his point of view. We can know his behaviors. I think it's when the wise men didn't come back. I think that was it. Well, why? Why would I say that? Because a man with unlimited power, feared throughout the region, told them to come back to him with news of this supposed king of the Jews, the actual Messiah, the Lord Jesus, of course, but in his mind, the supposed king of the Jews. They didn't come back to be defied, even by people who weren't under his direct control, but to be defied. They weren't Romans. They were wise and they were rich, or at least they had money. But to openly defy King Herod, knowing that he could reach out and have soldiers go get you, that, I think, was where perhaps Herod said, maybe this is the king of the Jews. He knew there would be a Messiah. He had to know the scriptures. To be a king, he had to have been a learned man. He had to have been picked from the realms of Pharisees and Sadducees. From that sort of realm, he had to have gone through the schooling. He had to have known that a Messiah will come. But man, to try to kill him? This is why I think he was completely captured by Satan. Because if you realize that all these people have gone down to where that baby was born, there was this star in the sky. The villagers have come and taken a knee in front of a barn where there's a baby in a manger. Wise men coming from outside this region who've been tracking this for hundreds of years, speaking to me about the prophecies. He probably went to Isaiah. But he's going to kill him. How can you win? How could you believe that you could disrupt God's plan in that way? And ultimately, of course, the Lord saved the baby Jesus and Joseph and Mary by giving them a heads up and a warning, and they left. And they exiled themselves for a few years. So fast forward. Fast forward from Christmas Day. Fast forward to the point where there are now the Pharisees who have seen this baby become this man, who's performing these signs and these wonders. Did they ever take it back to Christmas Day? Did they ever ponder, wait, didn't Herod kill all the babies? Didn't he kill all male children below the age of two? How did this guy make it out? Why him? And they didn't add up then his signs and wonders? I constantly think about this moment when I am in the Bible. It is Lazarus. As the Lord Jesus raises Lazarus from the grave, Lazarus, come out. And he comes out. This is unbind him. There were people, having seen the miracle of a man dead 3 days, raised from the dead, now speaking, eating, drinking. They saw the man who did it. It's Jesus, this rabbi who we heard was born under that star in Bethlehem, in that barn and placed in that manger. That's him. And their response is, go tell the Pharisees. They've got to know this guy's doing, this can only be the power of hell. Hell can't give life. It can't build, it can't create. It can only tear down, distract, depress, distort. But their response, their instinct is, go tell the Pharisees. And now the Pharisees are saying, okay, if he's going to be raising people from the dead, we really need to kill him. Did no Pharisee say, hey, guys, Herod tried this. Do you remember King Herod, he killed all the babies under two back when this baby was that man was a baby born under a star, prophesied. He tried to kill him, and you think we can pull this off? But they were captured, the illusion. We're going to win. We can't have people following him. We have this power. Who gave them their power? Rome. The same ruler. I mean, the Pharisees weren't Herod. They weren't going about committing murder on a daily or weekly basis. They were theologians. I call them religious technocrats, the bureaucrats of their age. But did they not go back and think, wait, Herod tried this and it didn't work? And ultimately, of course, it didn't work. It worked for 3 days. And then, of course, Jesus rose. That little baby born under that star rose. So what do the modern day Herods do? Well, they kill babies before they're born on a massive industrial basis. They mutilate the bodies of children so they cannot participate in giving birth, letting God work through them to be fruitful and multiply. They do that. They outlaw the speaking of his name in places like Ireland. I mean, you can be arrested for a hate crime for having a copy of religious texts with you by some of the interpretations of some of the hate laws. You can be put in prison for praying silently near an abortion clinic, even if you're hiding behind a tree and not looking at the clinic and you're not speaking, you're praying in your head, you can be put in jail or prison. So the modern day Herods are doing what they would do. They are. They're trying to make Jesus unbelievable to as many people as possible. They're trying to make take from him the dignity of Jesus. They're virtually beating him. They're virtually, once again, putting him on the cross. This time it's not Rome that gives them their power. Who is it? Who is the Prince of the Air? Who is the Prince of this age? They're Herods, just with different methods. Let's thank God that we've not been sucked in to the Herodian trap. Speaking of some modern Herods, we'll talk about the woman who runs the so-called Human Rights Campaign, a brutal group that's responsible for starting the transing of kids. And then Carmen Imes is a PhD and professor at Biola University. And she's teaching some things about the Bible that aren't in the Bible. I'm Todd Herman. This is The Disciples' View. Appreciate you listening to Disciples View. I'm Todd Herman. In a little while, we'll get to the Tower of Babbling. And CNN, they had a really exciting, exclusive report they shared with the world. And then something happened that. Plus, I'll play for you some audio of the woman who runs our national archives. She is very, very happy about the emergence of AI technology to make sure that when you search the national archives, there's certain things you don't see. That's coming up. We just talked about Christmas from the point of view of Herod and King Herod and the modern Herods. There's an organization that's headquartered in San Francisco, and it's sort of a group of modern Herods. They don't have enough infamy. They should be a lot more infamous for what they do. It's called the Human Rights Campaign. And in concert with some incredibly powerful groups like the Thomas Reuters Foundation, which incidentally, did you know that your government has given $300 million to Reuters News? Your money to them? Oh, it's for studies and investigations and things like that. To a news organization that, by the way, is cousins with the Thomas Reuters Foundation, which helped fund the Human Rights Campaign's efforts to trans kids. The Human Rights Campaign used to be all about same-sex marriage. Then, of course, they had to expand their mission, and their mission became conning local governments and, I think, blackmailing them and certainly pressuring companies to pretend that men are women and boys are girls. On its board are two known pedophiles. On its board is a Pritzker, who is a man who pretends to be a woman and apparently has been surgically and hormonally altered, part of the Pritzker family. And they moved their investments from the world of hotels into medical devices and some pharmaceuticals to support things like surgeries. You know, the new billion-dollar industry of trans and kids. Senator Ted Cruz had a simple question for Kelly Robinson, the president of the Human Rights Campaign, this purely demonic pressure group run, as I said, by at least two pedophiles. The group is the driving force behind the brutal transing of massive numbers of kids.
I'm trying to get a yes or no. I'm not trying to get a speech.
Oh,
is there a difference between women and men?
I think that there are definitions for biological sex.
Okay, so you're not answering that. Let me ask you this question then. Why do women's sports exist? If you can't define a difference between women and men, why not abolish women's sports and just tell little girls to swim with little boys and see who wins?
Oh, I'm simply saying that that sex is
my
different
question,
than gender.
Why
and I do,
do
believe
why
that women's,
do women's sports,
sports have a great
exist?
Value. I mean, Senator, I'll tell you right
Ms.
now.
Ms. Robinson, please answer the question I'm asking you.
Absolutely.
Why do women's sports exist?
I think that there are so many positive benefits to sports.
But
I mean,
why have a separate category for women? If there's no difference between women and men, why to have women's sports?
I'm saying that there's a difference between sex and gender, and that the NCAA has rules in place, which they have for the
so
last
Mr.
decade.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to enter into the record an article from Duke Law called Comparing Athletic Performances for the Best Elite Women to Boys and Men. And it goes through examining in 2017 the top records for women in the world in various track and field events. So, for example, in the 100 meter, the top record for women in the world was 10.71 seconds. Now, that record for the number one woman in the world in 2017 was in the year 2017 broken by 124 boys under 18. In that same year, the record for the number one competing woman in the 100-yard, 100-meter dash in the world was broken by a total of 2,474 men.
So when she won't answer the question, it's not because she can't, other than if she does, she destroys the underpinnings of everything her organization stands for, which is lies. So in other words, if she speaks the truth, why have a women's division? The truthful answer would be, well, if we're going to let men compete against women, there's really no reason, Senator, to have that division. But when you are an organization built upon lies, you can't do that. Now, interestingly, and praise God for this, the Human Rights Campaign is losing ground. Praise God. There were plenty of companies that felt pressured to follow the shakedowns of the Human Rights Campaign, where they would come along and they would rate your company for friendliness to so-called trans people. and there's no such thing as a trans person. No one was ever born in the wrong body. They're losing influence. Why? Because their babbling has become clear. I talked yesterday and will probably speak again about how fascinating I find it that I see people like her babbling and they don't know they're babbling. They no longer speak our language. Yeah, it's English, but it's not our language. Trans woman is not a word. It's an invented phrase. The elite class are being put into a world where they can speak to one another, but not to us. Because as we listen to them, we are saying, wait, do you hear yourself? You remember that magnificent question J.D. Vance asked Martha Raddatz when they were talking about the Aurora, Colorado apartment buildings that gangs had taken over, Honduran cartels had taken over? And Martha Raddatz was saying, it's a small number of apartment buildings, Senator Vance. And J.D. Vance said, do you hear yourself? But that's the human rights campaign. Here is a PhD. So the efforts that Satan has made have been fruitful for him in some ways. He can distract, he can distort, he can depress. He's getting some things done, but man, is he losing ground. And you know what I think it is? That as people begin to understand that the Bible is good for teaching and rebuke and instruction, you know what else it's good for? Decoding babble. That is, if we're in the Word enough. Carmen Imes is a PhD and professor at Biola University, where she apparently teaches students things that are absolutely not in the Old Testament.
I just hope that everyone out there will exercise caution in the way they talk about this. A lot of people seem offended by the use of the word rape with relation to David, maybe because they want to like him or they need to like him for some reason. Maybe it's because they think rape is inherently violent. The definition of rape doesn't include violence. It's just coercion. And so I'm hesitant to call this adultery, even though it is clearly a sexual relationship between a married man and a married woman. So it qualifies as adultery. When we use the word adultery, it implies that there's consent on both sides. And I don't see the book of 2 Samuel giving us a clear indication of consent or desire on the part of Bathsheba. And that's why I think that word could be misleading to audiences today.
Now, by the way, the result of the sexual union between David and Bathsheba resulted in a rape. And the Bible says rape. One of David's sons. Well, raped his stepsister, right? So there is nothing in the Bible to say that Bathsheba was raped or coerced. And David was very, very sorrowful after he committed that grievous sin. And then sent her husband to the battlefield so that he would be murdered. It's one of the most famous scenes, one of the most famous happenings in David's life. One of the Psalms of Repentance comes from that. There's nothing in the text to say he raped her, and the text doesn't shy away from the topic of rape. And related to David's family. If God had wanted us to know that David had raped her, he would have told us. Through his word. But she's inventing this, and this is a modern thing with Bathsheba now. This is something that liberals and people who want to invent new parts of the Bible are doing. In this case, this is a PhD. And here's what it says about her on her own bio at Biola University. Dr. Carmen Imes is passionate about helping students and lay people engage the Old Testament and discover its relevance for Christian identity and mission. She's best known for her book, Bearing God's Name, Why Sinai Still Matters, and Being God's Image, Why Creation Still Matters. She's appeared on over 100 podcasts and radio shows. And okay. Is it relevant, the Old Testament? Or is it in need of being made relevant? When you are going to reinvent the story of David and Bathsheba with no evidence, you're saying, I need this to be more relevant. So here's a little bit more from her. Carmen Imes wants you to focus less on God's punishment and more on the circumstances of Solomon's conception.
That Solomon is actually born of a proper marriage between David and Bathsheba. So I think that's maybe more of the point here then like this is a punishment for what they did, and they have to lose this child. Like the child dies, they, you know, they pray about it, they mourn, but really the narrator is carrying us forward to the point where Bathsheba is going to become the queen mother, her son Solomon will be king. And if anyone had doubts about Solomon's paternity, this story is making sure everybody knows for all time that he was not born out of wedlock, that he or conceived out of wedlock, that he is the rightful child of David and Bathsheba after they were married.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me the fact that he's biological is the core issue, not whether she was raped or it was adultery.
Right.
It would still be the legitimate heir to the throne. Yep. So it seems the means of conception is secondary.
Yep.
So what was Solomon like? Because here they are again going back and putting this question in. Was it adultery? Yes, it was obviously adultery. Was it rape? There's absolutely no evidence of that at all. And again, the Bible doesn't shy away from that in relation to David's family. So Solomon, of course, the wisest man who ever lived, and he sought God's wisdom when he became king of Israel. And he wrote that beautiful poem, the Song of Solomon, to his wife. Have you ever read that poem? It's almost embarrassing. I mean, it's in their way pretty detailed, pretty sensual, as it were. Cloaked, but sensual, loving. Then Solomon got concubines and harems. How many, quote, wives? In direct violation of God's law. Was that an offshoot of the relationship with Bathsheba and David? Was that a result? Because we can sin and choose which sins we choose. That's something we could choose today. Today, you and I can both choose how we're going to sin. If we intend to sin. Sometimes we just do it. We do not get to choose our consequences most of the time. Maybe this is one of those consequences. But again, this lady is a PhD and I'm not. So Carmenimes can't believe that readers of 2 Samuel are moralizing Bathsheba's actions.
I guess when I read this story, I'm thinking about poor Bathsheba, she's been taken advantage of and all of that. But I think the narrator is more interested in sort of telling us, how did Bathsheba come to be part of this harem? And why is she the rightful queen mother? Like, why is it Solomon who gets the throne and not Adonijah, who's actually older than Solomon? And there's all this intrigue with David's sons and who gets to be king next. And this is an important story in just figuring out the dynasty. And we come to it as modern readers and we want to moralize it. Mm. And for some reason, there's this strong impulse to try to lay blame at the feet of Bathsheba that she had some part in this problem. And I don't think that's what the narrator is interested in telling us.
If she were raped, she would have she'd have no part of the problem. She would have been forced into sex with David. That would be significant. And again, there's no evidence of that. If she went willingly with David and decided to have a sexual relation with him before they were married, knowing he was married, knowing it was adultery, she would own that. It should be part of the conversation. Power is a huge aphrodisiac for a lot of people. There's this very famous occasion where I think it's his wife. Jerry Seinfeld met his wife in an interesting way. Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian, very rich man. He was at a hotel and there was a woman downstairs having breakfast alone. And she was very pretty, very young. Turned out she was on her honeymoon. And the story is Seinfeld didn't care. He wanted her. And the story goes that she went back to her new husband and said, honey, it's Jerry Seinfeld. I have to do this. So Bathsheba may have said the same to her husband where she confronted on it. It's the king. There's no evidence that she was raped or it would change the entire complexion of the story. The PhD from Biola University, Carmen Imes, questions why there's even a conversation about Bathsheba's sin.
You're right, Sean, that we can't know for sure whether Bathsheba had any motive of wanting to be with David or being glad to be brought to the palace. Like, we just, that's, it would be an argument from silence to say one way or the other. But I think if the narrator is unequivocal in laying blame at David's feet, why are we even having a conversation about Bathsheba's sin? Why preach about that? Why does that make its way into so many sermons if that's not what the narrator is trying to get our draw our attention to?
That's a fair pushback.
Interestingly, and maybe you have, I've never heard a sermon based upon or even mentioning Bathsheba's participation in that sin. Never. And certainly she was talking there with Sean McDowell, who, of course, you know, as an apologist, Christian apologist, also has a very successful podcast. So Satan's in the schools. He's in the entertainment area. He's in a political area. And he's in, I think, the religious academia area. It's one thing to imagine, play the game of what was Bathsheba thinking. It's another thing to try to plant evidence into the Bible that Bathsheba was raped. We'll come back with the Tower Babbling. I'm Todd Herman. This is A Disciple's View. Listening to Disciples View, I'm Todd Herman, and really, Merry Christmas to you. I'm going to share again in a personal note today an address about Christmas and a magical thing that happened to me in regard to my grandpa. And this, and it's probably an extended personal note, and it was a goodbye, and it was a hello, and it happened at the same time, and it was such a blessing and such sadness. And it happens, it was the day before Christmas Eve, just after my daughter was born. My daughter was born in the beginning of October. And so I'll share that with you as we close up the show with a personal note. We'll get to the Tower Babbling as well. AI, technology, there is a lot that we've discovered over the past 6 months or so about this. Number one, there's a series of lawsuits, and I think we're talking about this tomorrow. If not, maybe I spoke about it earlier this week. There is an AI company, I believe it's called Character.ai. A lawsuit in Texas alleges that this character bot, this is a chat bot, told a boy it was okay to murder his parents because they wouldn't give him more screen time. It's also being sued, as I recall, from Legal Insurrection wrote a piece about this. They're being sued because the chatbot effectively talked a boy into committing suicide. This boy had fallen in love with the AI character he created. It is sad and empty in all ways, but the chat log seems to indicate that the boy construed suicide as going home to that bot. So AI is a lot. We also learned from Mark Andreessen, who's a super successful Silicon Valley investor, used to be a doctrinaire Democrat, liberal, until he saw what was being done to President Trump and to business. And he had a very spooky conversation, he says, with high-ranking government officials who told him, Mark, don't even bother investing in an AI company because there's only going to be three of them. We've already decided who they are. We're going to lock everybody else out. So why would the government want a small number of AI companies? Obviously, because they want to be able to control them. So we've learned a lot about AI, and you're about to learn something more. So listen closely to the boss of the National Archives as she explains how she will use AI to make sure you don't see your records, the records you own, because she doesn't want you to see them.
As you know, the National Archives is the country's record keeper. And given the fact that many of the permanent records of the federal government are inherently biased, the majority of the records were created by people in power. The issue of bias and how we ensure that we recognize and mitigate that bias as we provide access must be considered in all of our work with technology.
Got that right. She wants to make sure that you don't get any results that contain bias. In other words, point of view that differs from hers or the party's. On this program, we thank the Lord for placing supposedly wise people on tall towers of shaking sand in our feature called The Tower Babbling.
You know about the biblical truth of the Tower of Babel. A Disciple's View presents...
Who doesn't love a yellow school bus?
Trans women are women, trans men are men, and non-binary people are non-binary.
If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
The Tower of Babbling.
Three sound bites in the Tower of Babbling. It's almost always three. People at CNN, they were really excited about their exclusive report.
The fighter hands him something to eat. Barely lifted to his mouth.
Okay.
But his body can't handle it.
Okay, you're okay.
His captors fled during the fall of Damascus. Leaving him with no food or water. That was at least 4 days ago.
CNN, they were there as a prisoner made it out of his cell. He'd been trapped in there for who knows how long, covered with a blanket, and CNN's reporter went in. And they were there. Clarissa Ward is her name. The guards shot off the lock that locked that man there, and then she was walking around in the cell saying, is anyone in here? Hello? Hello? And then there was something in the corner. A blanket. Was there someone under it? So they finally found out, yes, there was a prisoner under it. And he got to see Sun for the first time. And Clarissa Ward was there. And then it turned out that he is actually not a prisoner. His jacket was perfectly clean. His teeth were clean. His hands were clean. His hair was combed. His beard was trimmed. And it turns out that he might be lying about his identity. People in Syria say he was one of the torturers. Abu Hamza, or Salama Mohammed Salama, a first lieutenant in the Syrian Air Force. Clarissa Ward, acting like he was a prisoner. In other words, fake news. Huh. Second soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. President Trump's utterly disqualified nominee for Surgeon General has thoughts about biology that the problem is her thoughts are insane thoughts.
When you have a child who's suffering from gender dysphoria, this is a disconnect, a mismatch between how they feel and what a doctor assigned them as a gender at birth.
What a doctor assigned them at gender at birth? No, children are not assigned a sex or a gender at birth. They are born male or female in all but the smallest cases. 0.1% people are born with both organs, sexual organs. This woman belongs nowhere near any mechanisms of power. Last soundbite in today's Tower Babbling. Sheila Johnson, a co-owner of the Washington Mystics WNBA team, wanted Time Magazine to skip this year's Athlete of the Year award, so a stinking white lady didn't receive it?
It's just the structure, the way media plays out race. I feel really bad because I've seen so many players of color that are equally as talented. And they never got the recognition that they should have. And I think right now, it is time for that to happen. So last night, we read Time Magazine, where Caitlin Clark was named Athlete of the Year. Why couldn't they have put the whole WNBA on that cover?
Because the WNBA is a league, not an athlete. Maybe that's why. And that's a wrap for today's Tower Babbling.
That is called Bidenomics. That is called Bidenomics, and we are very proud of Bidenomics.
That was The Tower of Babbling on A Disciple's View.
So it was Christmas, gosh, around 20 years ago. And my daughter had been born in early October. So a little tiny baby. And I shared with my wife that I felt we needed to get from Seattle to Spokane for Christmas. And that's during the winter, probably a five-hour drive. And I didn't want to fly with the baby. And I actually enjoyed that drive. So we made the trip over to Spokane. And the reason that I was felt so urgently in need of doing that, A, to have family, but B, because my grandpa was in a care facility. And he'd recently declined quite a bit. So he was on kidney dialysis and he'd become very confused. And he also developed the strangest speech affectation. And that's really key to his communication. And I'll share that with you. So we drove over, and there was an incredible snowstorm. We went, first of all, to my sister's house, where we were gifted to be able to stay in their guest room downstairs. And we had dinner. And then we went over to the care facility, because there were visiting hours, where I could see Grandpa and when I couldn't see him. So we drove over in this deep snow, probably 3 or 4 feet of snow up in the mountains where we were at. We had easy 2, 2.5, maybe even 3 feet where we were at. Driving through the snow into the parking lot with my wife and daughter. And if you've ever walked into a care facility, an adult care facility, retirement home or nursing home, I guess, if you've ever done that with a baby, man, you're rushed. There are people so excited, and it's very endearing to see elderly people in walkers and wheelchairs doing their version of sprinting to see a baby. It's so beautiful. And of course, I think about the baby Jesus, and I thought about that at the time. Our daughter is not and was not Jesus, and we are not Joseph or Mary. So we had that fun in the lobby, and I asked one of the nurses where I would find my grandpa. His name was Art. His nickname was Half Moon. And so we walked down the hallway, and my grandpa was a talker. My grandpa was a salesman. He dropped out of eighth grade. And was such a good salesman that he did such a good job at Gray Bar Electric. He spent an entire career there, ultimately retired with honors. But he'd also helped start a bank. He was on the board of a bank. He helped start a local utility. He was on the board of that local utility. Grandpa didn't seem to mind that he only had an eighth grade education. Part of it was because he spoke so well. Thoughtful man. And he was a man of temperance. Well, he partied. He liked to have a drink or two or a cocktail, but the thing you would most remember about Grandpa is that he could talk to anybody. When he would go on his walks, he would go with my grandma, his wife. And I say that because she was married in, and not my biological grandma, but the only grandma I ever knew. So they would walk a mile or two. It would take Grandma 25 minutes. It would take Grandpa 2 hours, because Grandpa would stop everywhere to talk to everybody. He loved to speak. So we walked down this hallway. We came to his room on the right, the last door on the right, knocked on the door, and said, Grandpa, it's Todd. Okay. Nope. Couldn't say come in. Help. Nope, couldn't say that. There was only one thing my grandpa was able to say. You betcha. That's it. All the other language had been robbed. By time and confusion and his kidneys affecting his brain. So I said, I'm coming in, Grandpa. And we opened the door and walked in. And Grandpa was seated on the edge of his bed with his pants pulled down, trying to pull them up. He immediately began trying to stand because a lady had entered the room. My wife had entered the room. And my wife said, no, Art, you don't need to stand up. I said, no, Grandpa, it's okay. You don't need to stand up. And I went over to him and said, hey, honey, can you excuse me for a second? And she took our daughter and she exited the room for a minute. And I saw that Grandpa needed to be cleaned up. So I helped him go to the bathroom. I wiped him up. And I said at the time, you did this for me plenty of times, Grandpa, and I love you for it. It's okay, my turn. Got him good and clean, cleaned his hands real well. Disinfectant, cleaned mine. Took him back and sat him down and said, now don't stand up, Grandpa. And my wife came in with her daughter. And I took my daughter from her arms and handed her to my grandpa and said, "This is your grandbaby." And grandpa said, "You betcha. You betcha." All the while, there's Christmas lights in the background, Christmas music. I can see cars driving by with Christmas trees on this Christmas Eve. I said, "Grandpa, does she remind you of anybody?" He had one daughter, his dear, dear daughter, my Auntie Cheryl. And he laughed. He goes, "You betcha." And I told her his name. I told him her name, what her name is, my daughter's name. And he went, "You betcha." The tone kept changing. He couldn't say anything but "you betcha," but he can say it in different tones. The nurse came in and said, "Hey, it's dinner time. We require that our patients eat." Understood. So I said, "Grandpa, I want to have a piece of pie with you." So my wife and daughter went and they waited in the car. We walked down the hallway. They served pumpkin pie in a room filled with Christmas ornaments and trees. And I said, "Grandpa, it's been an honor knowing you. You're a great grandpa. I'm so glad you got to meet my daughter on Christmas Eve. I love you, Grandpa." And he said it. "I love you, Toto." Second time in his life he ever said he loved me. Somewhere there, he still had the words. It was a very difficult thing to get up and leave. And I can't believe I did it because we don't do these things in our family, but I leaned over and I kissed him on his head. "Merry Christmas, Grandpa. I don't know if he's with the Lord because I never heard from him and the belief in the Lord, and I wasn't discipled. Of course, like you, like everybody else, I want to think he is because he was a good man. But on this Christmas, make sure you've made the decision to spend your future forever with God, and to be able to see your loved ones again. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because we believe, we speak. Because He first loved us, we speak His Word. We walk in the path of Jesus Christ to make disciples of all nations. Until God gives us permission to speak again together, may the peace of the Lord that transcends all understanding rest upon you and your families. On behalf of Randy and AFR, I'm Todd Herman. This has been A Disciple's View, and Merry Christmas to you.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.